Hey, just wanted to let you know, this week's episode of Pop Culture Happy Hour contains some language that you don't usually hear on this show. So if that is a concern, we just wanted to make sure you had fair warning in advance.
There are tens of thousands of podcasts out there, and it's hard to know what's good. But WAMU and NPR's The Big Listen have come to the rescue. Host Lauren Ober introduces you to podcasts you might never have heard of and gives you the inside scoop on shows you already love, like the one you're listening to right now. Find The Big Listen on the NPR One app and at npr.org/podcasts.
Welcome to Pop Culture Happy Hour, NPR's roundtable podcast about what we're watching, reading, and listening to. I'm Stephen Thompson. This week, we will break down Dave Chappelle's new stand-up specials for Netflix, then take a look at a new movie reboot of the TV cop show Chips. And as always, we'll close the show with what's making us happy this week. But before we get started here in historic Studio 44, let's go around the table.
I'm Glenn Weldon. I write for the NPR website.
I'm Gene Demby. I'm the host of the Code Switch podcast.
And in our fourth chair today is Brittany Luce. Hello, Brittany.
Hi.
Now, Brittany, could you tell the nice people what you do?
Yes, I am co-host of For Colored Nerds podcast, and I am also the host of an upcoming project at Gimlet Media that I cannot yet speak about because I still know very little about it.
Ooh. Well, we are waiting anxiously for that to reveal itself. Okay, so before we jump in on Dave Chappelle, I do want to remind everyone that tickets are still available for our Chicago live show on April 12th with Sam Sanders in our fourth chair and our special guest, W. Kamau Bell. You can get those tickets at nprpresents.org. Okay, so on March 22nd, comedian Dave Chappelle released two stand-up specials on Netflix. The first one is titled The Age of Spin, Live at the Hollywood Palladium. It was recorded in March of 2016. The second, titled Deep in the Heart of Texas, Live at Austin City Limits, was recorded in April 2015. So he's been digging in the vaults here. They mark a major and somewhat controversial return to television for Dave Chappelle, whose career has included a famous two-year run on Comedy Central's Dave Chappelle Show, appearances in films like Half-Baked and Blue Streak, and several hiatuses from acting and comedy. So before we get into the new stand-up specials, I want to do a quick run around the table and just have each person just give me a quick answer to the question, what does Dave Chappelle mean to you? Gene, I'm going to start with you.
Killing Them Softly, which was his special, I think, in like 2000?
Yeah, 99 or 2000.
Yeah, something like that. Was one, I think, at the time, the funniest thing I think I'd ever seen on TV.
Mm-hmm. That's a stand-up special.
Right, and he's like a much skinnier, much younger Dave Chappelle. He looks very different now. Yep. There's this weird, absurdist bent in his humor, especially around race, that you saw sort of show up in the later stuff like Chappelle's Show. I mean, like, what if you were a white supremacist who was also a black person who was blind and did not know that you were black?
Oh, that's right.
So much of his jokes are just like him setting up an absurd racial premise and then following it to its ridiculous conclusion. And I just thought it was just really fun and really subversive, but that is not really true of the new stuff.
We'll get to that in a second.
Yeah. I saw him a concert 2 years ago with Nas at Radio City Music Hall. I was a huge Chappelle fan, so this was like a thing I've been eagerly anticipating for a long time.
Okay, Brittany, how about you?
Yeah, Dave Chappelle was like one of the first comedians that I actually really saw like get into laughing at himself. Mm-hmm. Like my favorite thing that he does, and he only did it a couple times in new specials, is like hit like his leg with the microphone and like just pause to laugh at his own joke. Like, I just love that. Like, he was somebody whose like delivery was just so gleeful. Well, a lot of times just like poking holes in just like these ridiculous like racial tropes in this really smart and sharp way. Not only that, like, I remember watching his comedy. I remember growing up knowing that I wasn't allowed to watch Richard Pryor. Mm-hmm. But for some reason, I was allowed to watch Dave Chappelle with my parents. So he was like, you know, there's something important about what this guy was saying that like, my parents wanted to be a part of my art, like, upbringing. So mm-hmm. we all used to watch Chappelle's Show DVDs, like, together.
Yeah.
So, like, Dave Chappelle was, like, I would say maybe the defining, like, comic voice of, like, my young life. And I didn't see him. I was actually too broke to see him at Radio City in 2014. Oh. A lot of people I know saw him and have the T-shirt. Mm-hmm. I get grief for it all the time. But I did see him about a year and a half ago in 2014. 15, I wasn't totally surprised by the new stuff. But he was everything to me when I was a teenager and a young person.
Okay. How about you, Glenn?
I was a fan. I mean, I was a little bit older when the show was on. It was on between 2003 and 2005. And that's right at the cusp of easy shareability of this kind of thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, YouTube launched in 2005. So if you wanted to see this show, you had to, you know, align your DVR or you had to get the DVDs. So I caught it a lot. I caught it as often as I could because I really enjoyed it. But I wouldn't call myself a super fan. Hmm.
Yeah, I'm somewhat in the same boat. I mean, you say that you had to come by the DVDs. I believe the DVDs are still the best-selling TV-to-DVD package in history.
That's crazy.
So, like many people, I bought up the DVDs and, as a comedy nerd, enjoyed them that way. But he kind of disappeared. He kind of went into self-imposed exile and became a little bit more of like a, like almost like a Lauryn Hill figure.
Right.
Where it's like he had this like legendary but small body of work and then kind of was more mysterious. Mm-hmm. And so I tended to connect with him more that way. A couple of people have alluded to it thus far. These specials, these Netflix specials, the reaction to them is a little bit more mixed, and I'm sensing that already in the room. Gene, because I've read you tweeting about them and had conversations with you about them, what is your deal with these specials?
So we should back up a little bit and just say that, like, Chappelle, these two things have happened at the same time. So Chappelle, you know, he walks away from his fame. He famously walks away from, like, a $50 million contract with Comedy Central.
Right.
And so him doing that has, like, imbued him with all this sort of, like, oh, this is a man of deep principle. And he's, like, and in the interim, to your point about Lauryn Hill, right, he's become this figure of, like, this fascination of fascination. Mm-hmm. And he's, like, this a growing mystique in his absence. At the same time, like, so much of Black politics has changed dramatically since then, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, even, you know, like, we talk about stuff like police shootings. Like, you know, Black Lives Matter was spearheaded by three queer women of color, right? Mm-hmm. And so, like, so much of the politics of our moment of the last, you know, especially the last 5 or 6 years has been wrapped up in this idea that, like, you are not Black or gay, or you are all, like, people sit in all these identities at the same
intersectional
time.
Intersectional.
Right. Yeah. I was trying to use not say intersectional.
it was the elephant in the room.
We always try not to do that on Code Switch. And so when you hear him make a joke in the new special about, like, oh, I have these hood dudes in Brooklyn who need to walk around in heels so they don't get arrested by the police because it's easier to be gay or trans than it is to be a Black man. It's like, one, those aren't different identities. Two, all the stuff we know about, like, what it means to be a trans person of color shows that, like, you know, those people are especially at risk, right? So what you see in the special seems to be this collision of him, like, opting out of the culture and, you know, a lot of people looking to him to say this, like, really insightful stuff at the same time that so much has changed and he's clearly not been in those conversations. These are lazy jokes about, like, trans people are weird, gay people are weird, men who are feminine,
in gay couples, which one's the wife?
Right.
You know,
I mean,
it's like,
this would have been, like, old stuff in the 70s, you know?
Yeah.
Like, it would have been old and problematic 15, 20 years ago, you know?
Yeah. How about you, Glenn?
Yeah, I mean, comedy is subjective, right? And so when I say that, you know, 10 or 15 minutes would pass by without me laughing once, that just tells you that anything could be happening, right?
Mm-hmm.
I could be in a bad mood, whatever. This is objective. I do know that whatever follows the phrase, I don't have anything against gay people, but, doesn't interest me.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it will not be fresh, and it will not be new.
Right,
you might as well, you're just hearing bird noises at that point.
I mean, the appeal of him has always been, back in the day, he had a vulnerability.
Mm-hmm.
And that has been replaced by, I think, a kind of insecurity. This is the thing I do when a lot of time goes by without me laughing. I start throwing all these pop psychology things. It occurs to me that he gets most animated twice. Once when he's talking about how much his son loves Kevin Hart, which is just fraught.
Mm-hmm.
And once when he tells a story about misgendering somebody at a party and gets corrected.
Mm.
And I think that's what we're talking about here. It's not necessarily the misgendering. It's the fact that he was corrected.
Yeah. Well, he sees the culture passing him by.
Well, that's it. I mean, like, so he went from being vulnerable to being insecure. Vulnerability is about risking harm, and insecurity is about risking status, risking position. And he can't navigate the space the way he used to in the kind of unthinking way. And so now the idea that these people are inconveniencing me by existing, right? That trans people are, they're asking too much.
He says, like, I shouldn't have to learn new pronouns.
That's exactly the point. That's exactly it. So that is not speaking truth to power. And I've been reading some of the reaction, and online, on Twitter especially, people are saying, yeah, he's just as controversial. He's just as laser-focused, and he's burning bridges, and that's what he always did. No, because now he's siding with people who don't want to be inconvenienced by the changing culture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That is not punching up, as we say. That's punching down. That is that is being conflated with people who want to deny people's existence. That's not the role he has traditionally played.
Yeah. How about you, Brittany?
No, I think the point that you make about punching down as opposed to punching up, like when you watch Killing Him Softly, mm-hmm. like it's great because you're looking at him. He looks like anybody. He's dressed like anybody. This is like 1999, 2000 Dave Chappelle. Mm-hmm. So he's not like, you know, rich. You know what I mean?
Right.
Which is, I'll get to that in a second. But he's just like a skinny black man from D.C. who like is like the way that he talks and like his point of view are things that like that seem like I could access them in my everyday life. Like they feel familiar to me. Like new Dave Chappelle obviously has a gym membership, obviously eating good. Obviously eating good. I have a friend who like works in Dayton, sometimes sees him in the Whole Foods talking on the phone. So like new Dave Chappelle also like isn't just rich, but has been rich for a very long time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So some of the very first jokes that he makes in the first special, like the Detroit jokes, the Flint water jokes. But there's also this one line where he says something about like how he was supposed to go to this, he's supposed to do this show at like a fundraiser, like a Flint water fundraiser.
It was the same day as the Oscars. Right, I know. So I was on my way to the airport to go to Flint, and then Chris Rock calls me and is like, hey, Dave, I got a ticket for you for the Oscars. Can you make it? And I was like, sure, nigga, I'm on my way to the airport right now. Oh, come on, man. What am I going to do about that water? What am I, a fucking superhero? I need to have fun. I need to live, too. I didn't fuck that water up. Stevie Wonder was there. They didn't need me. I'm sorry, everybody. I've never been to the Oscars. You've seen the movies I make.
And it's like, okay, on one hand, I guess technically I get where you're coming from. But on the other hand, like, you're having princess problems.
You don't actually
have to work. Like, you've been out of the loop for a really long time, but in a way that you chose.
Right.
Now, I get the reasons that he did that. I totally understand. And in the interim, he had a really good interview with Oprah in 2006. He had a really great taped conversation on the Iconoclast special with Maya Angelou. So, like, I've seen, like, the introspective, like, thoughtful side of Dave Chappelle, and I felt like that was who he was kind of, like, developing into. But it's weird because I feel like I've gotten this person now who's, like, a rich black Archie Bunker. And, like, I know that Dave Chappelle is older, but, like, he's only 42.
He's not that old. He's 42.
Right.
Yeah, he ain't that old.
Yeah, he's, like, 42, 43 years old. He's still pretty young. So for him to be as out of touch as he is, like, I don't know. I feel disappointed. I feel like some parts I laughed. There were some jokes that worked, but they were usually just one-liners,
mm-hmm.
Or quick observations, like things that seemed like they were thrown in, or him like playing off of the crowd's energy. The actual material that it seems like he was putting forth in these specials broke my heart, man.
Yeah, and it's weird because you can hear it in some of his older stuff. You can see like flickers of some of this this weird, mm-hmm. these like his weird gender issues, right? I mean, mm-hmm. even in the Oprah interview you just cited, I think he was saying like, you know, in the end. But what Hollywood wants is to put all black men in dresses. And, you know, like, you hear Hotep say stuff like that all the time.
Yeah.
But it was weird, like, to hear, you know, like, I mean, like, now that seems, like, much more ominous, like, watching this special, like, oh, this that was the seed of this right. thing that's obviously like, taking much deeper root in his thinking.
Mm-hmm.
My reaction to a lot of the gay stuff, is, as you said, was just how stale it was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I wasn't necessarily, like forming a pitchfork-wielding mob so much as I just felt like, oh, my God, is this 1983?
Mm-hmm.
The notion of having opted out of the culture, of kind of taking himself out of the comedy world, going on sabbatical, moving to a farm in Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
Comedy is incredibly hard in many ways. And one of the hardest things to do in comedy, especially when you are a comedy legend, as Dave Chappelle is you have to stay up on what people are saying. You almost can't take sabbaticals from it because you come back to a different world than the one you left.
Mm-hmm.
And so many of the jokes in there, I'm thinking like, these jokes are going culturally extinct.
Mm-hmm.
Like there is going to come a point at which like this will just be embarrassing.
Right. Well, we've talked about how he's opted out of the culture and the conversation, but I would argue that he's opting back in, and he's opting back in on the side of people, and his audience is largely white. That might not be a coincidence, at least in these two specials.
Right.
Opting back in on the side of people who would say things like, well, what about these people over here, right?
Right.
You and I, we're normal. These right. people over here, that's, you can't dismiss that. Like, that's a choice.
Hmm. Right. And there are laughs scattered through this thing. This thing is not, I don't mean to suggest that I sat there with my arms folded the entire time. There's a very funny, late in the LA special, for example, there's a really, really funny bit where he's setting up, taking his 12-year-old son to see Kevin Hart in concert.
Then Kevin takes the stage, crowd goes fucking nuts. thousands of people. I was furious.
Chappelle has always had this ability to, like, make things funny or funnier just because he's the person saying them, you know? Mm-hmm. You know, there's a bunch of, like, to Britney's point, like, a lot of stuff that he said that was just funny because the way he says things is funny, just the way his voice sounds. And his cadence is just weird and strange and off-kilter in a lot of ways. But, like, it felt like he was often, like, weaponizing that for ill in so many places in these specials, right? I mean, and I wonder, because he occupies this big... this specific cultural space now, if the people who were cracking up in the crowd when he was telling these jokes, the gay and trans jokes, if they felt like almost compelled, like, I'm here, I spent all this money in the Chappelle show, right? Like, and he's Dave Chappelle, I need to laugh, right?
Where the laughter is like, ha, Dave Chappelle!
Yeah, exactly, right.
There is a power to the nostalgia here, right? Because I did not realize how much I missed his white guy laugh.
Yes.
How much I missed his white guy voice.
Yeah.
It's a part of me in a lot of different ways, but man, he just nails it every time.
Mm-hmm.
My recommendation, if you are going to jump in, I mean, if you've got a Netflix subscription, it's not like you're going to pay-per-view to watch these. The L.A. one, for me, was a lot less dire than the Austin one.
I thought they were both equally bad because one of the prevailing jokes in the L.A. one, the first one, is this Bill Cosby, he rapes, but he sings
joke. Yeah, the Bill Cosby joke.
You're right.
Right.
We got this far without mentioning Bill Cosby jokes.
Exactly. I got the first germs of that joke when I saw him in September 2015. We get to the end, and I knew things were going to take a turn as soon as he said the word rape the first time.
Yeah.
And then he just, like, drew the joke out for another 10 minutes.
Yeah.
And it was similar to the stand-up specials on Netflix in that, like, half of the people were laughing really hard and the other half of the people were like, I thought I came here to see somebody else. Like, this wasn't what I was expecting. Like, why? And also, I like to go see live comedy a fair amount, and I feel like usually jokes like that people will try to put somewhere in the middle so that, like, they end on something that you really, 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 like, everybody can feel good about. So, like, I actually left that show with kind of a bad taste in my mouth. So then when I watched the LA special and he had Bill Cosby jokes just sprinkled throughout, I was like, how can you get me out of this? Like, when is this going to end? He had this really good O.J. Simpson story device that was, like, also working progressively all the way through the show until, like, the very tip tail of the end.
Yeah.
I kind of wish he had, like, leaned into that one a little bit more and sort of eased up on the Cosby stuff because it made the first one practically unwatchable. I mean, like you said, there are some moments in there. Like, the Kevin Hart joke I thought was amazing. To me, it was like all of those things I had to sort of, like, pick and choose.
Why is it that comedians, as they age and become rich, sort of double down on, like, what I said was really not politically correct, right? We saw Seinfeld do this, right? Where Jerry Seinfeld was saying, college kids today don't have any sense of the humor, right? You've seen Chris Rock complain about this stuff. This sense that, like, the stuff they're saying is just so, it's so sharp and incisive that it's going to offend people, as if, like, that is in itself is a metric they use for how good the comedy is.
Comedians capture the moment, right? Or at least that's the idea. They capture the cultural moment, and then the cultural moment moves on. And if they don't, they're like your dad who still wears the sweater vest. It's like, Dad, nobody dresses like this anymore. They just stop trying. It's a comedic sweater vest.
I'm using that.
Well, on that note, I'm guessing the people listening to this have some thoughts on Dave Chappelle, on comedy. Hit us up on Facebook, facebook.com/PCHH. When we come back, we're going to have David Green join Glenn Weldon and me for a discussion of the hot new movie Chips. So come right back.
Support for this NPR podcast and the following message come from Blue Apron. Blue Apron partners with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to bring you all the ingredients you need to create incredible home-cooked meals. Ingredients come paired with an easy-to-follow recipe card delivered to your door weekly in a refrigerated box. Rediscover how fun cooking can be while enjoying specialty ingredients and exploring new flavors and cuisines. Get your first three Blue Apron meals free plus free shipping by visiting blueapron.com/happyhour.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. We have got a different lineup for you in this segment. Gone for the moment are Brittany Luce and Gene Demby, though they will return to tell us what's making them happy this week. And in their place is just one man, David Green. David, tell us what you do again.
That was quite an intro, Stephen. Wow. I'm one of the hosts of Morning Edition at NPR, so I, you know, wake up ungodly early. I'm hosting from California these days, so I go to work around midnight and have a great group of colleagues here, and we just burn the midnight oil and put radio on the air.
All right. So sending you to a movie...
It's hard. I'm asleep at good movie times, but with my hours, you go to a movie around 11:30 a.m., and the movie theater is depressing. It's empty.
So at the beginning of this week, if you scanned the very top of the box office reports, you would see the continued dominance of your Beauty and the Beast, see your Power Rangers, see a few other movies, then all the way down at number 7, the opening bow of Chips, an R-rated action comedy starring Dax Shepard and Michael Peña. The movie... for those who aren't aware of it, loosely reboots a late 70s and early 80s motorcycle cop show, also called Chips, but this version adds nudity and assorted raunch to the usual expected bike chases. Now, the whole thing was written and directed by Dax Shepard, so you get the sense that it was a labor of love on some level. Shepard has directed before. He did Hit and Run, which was a very profitable, low-budget action movie back in 2012, but he's best known as an actor in stuff like Idiocracy, the TV show Parenthood. You see him play dumb guy a lot. When we cast around for someone who might want to talk about Chips, we heard from David Green in a big, big way. I'm assuming
I was the only one who raised a hand.
You not only raised a hand, you were enthusiastic. Now, I'm assuming this is because hosting Morning Edition has really opened your eyes to the most important issues of the day. You had your finger on the pulse. You said Chips. Now, I'm assuming, David, you said this because you maybe watched the original Chips at some point in your life.
Yeah. No, I did. I was growing up in Pittsburgh, and I would come home after school and watch reruns of Chips, and I loved it. I mean, I'd never been to L.A., and so to see sunny California every day and the palm trees and the whole vibe and two dudes cruising around on motorcycles, getting into trouble, being heroes, I don't know. There was just something simple and relatable and awesome.
Something relatable?
I don't know. Like, I would play with Matchbox toys and run around my living room with, like, little cars and motorcycles and buses. So I was like, I could be on that motorcycle. I could be Punch.
The audience at home, edge of their seats, bated breath. David Green, what did you think of Chips, the movie?
So I had high expectations. I live in L.A. now. And so, there was something really special about going and seeing this movie. The movie theater was totally empty, which might tell you something about the movie. I don't know. It wasn't satisfying. It didn't feel like the TV series. First of all, they didn't do the theme music. You didn't see Punch and John, the close-ups of their bikes and their badges and everything, the way that, you know, they would do the opening to every episode. That was sad. And I don't know, like, there was raunchiness, there was humor. I liked the cast. The cast is great. They were fun, but it didn't feel... like Chips, maybe they just tried to do too much and make it too different. So as Chips, it kind of fell flat, but the cast, you know, at least kept me along for the ride.
I had the same reaction to the cast. I really like Dax Shepard. He tends to pop up in things and be like, ah, that guy. And Kristen Bell, who's, you know, in real life married to Dax Shepard, she's always delightful.
Forgetting Sarah Marshall, I would go to anything with her in it.
Yeah, I am in the tank for Kristen Bell. I have enjoyed Michael Peña in things. Glenn, what did you think of this movie before?
This movie leaves no impression, but in fairness, it's not intended to. That's not its mission statement. On paper, this should work, right? I mean, because you've got, as you say, Michael Peña, Dax Shepard, both great actors. My issue, one of many, was that the Michael Peña character of Punch is a complete D-bag. Yeah. And so you can do something in other films. You can have, like, a character exhibiting a kind of a baseline homophobia, which then gets underlined by the script in a way he gets called out on it. That can work on paper to kind of undercut it in a way, but not when the character is such a jerk.
You know, I think the biggest problem to me with that character is that it was not Eric Estrada.
My take on this movie, I had some of the same issues that you did, Glenn. I felt like the way they introduced the Michael Peña character and that they referenced sort of homophobia and like, what, you don't want to hug me? What? It felt like they wanted to be raunchy and they wanted to tiptoe right up to the line. They also kind of kept walking it back in this weird, tentative way.
Disingenuous.
Kind of disingenuous way of like, what, you're homophobic. No, homophobia is blah, blah, blah.
That's exactly right. It felt like, I mean, if you're going to be over-the-top raunchy and totally insensitive and offensive, it's like, just go there, do it, get it over with. And, you know, you feel that. It's like, okay, these characters are just total jerks. But they tried to walk this line. If you're going to open the door and act like you're going to deal with it, you know, a sensitive subject like homophobia in a real way, then you've got to deal with it in a real way. And it was just something that was unsatisfying, didn't quite get there.
Well, this movie shares so much of its narrative DNA with, like, 21 Jump Street, for example, and its strategy of bringing back cameos, spoiler. And yet that film didn't feel this way. And I think it all comes down to the chemistry of the two leads, who the characters are both doofuses and lovable in different ways. But you don't have this sort of snide dynamic. You don't have a scene in which the joke is he accidentally sexes with a woman in her 60s. But then it's okay because she's got a rockin' bod. Like that? Right. It's fraught.
Yeah, I actually watched 21 Jump Street to prepare for this conversation. And it is fascinating, A, how similar these movies are on paper. Mm-hmm. They are reworkings of properties that are not necessarily on the top of everyone's minds. And I don't mean to suggest that 21 Jump Street is some incredibly important work of art. It is not a major film. It is not awards bait. But what I kept coming back to in that movie is just how fun it is. It's not even necessarily like, oh my God, there are a million billion jokes. Mm-hmm. It's people who are having fun in a movie that is having fun. Mm. And it is a very, very different experience. There's also, you know, when we talk about the friendship between Michael Peña and Dax Shepard in Chips, versus the friendship between Jonah Hill and Channing Tatum in 21 Jump Street, there's a scene in 21 Jump Street where, like, their friendship has been tested and they kind of are becoming friends again. And Jonah Hill says to Channing Tatum something like, you know, you are my friend. You were important to me. He says, I cherish you. And it's not a joke.
Yeah.
It's not like, I cherish you, no homo. And so there is this underlying warmth to the characters that I think is missing in Chips.
You know what I think about when I was getting ready to talk to you guys? I mean, I was watching the original Star Wars movies at the same age as I was watching reruns of Chips. Mm-hmm. And there was just this simple innocence and almost predictability to the characters. It's like Luke Skywalker, Han Solo, Princess Leia. I mean, it was not the best acting, but it was good versus evil, and the narrative was easy to grab onto, and it was just fun. And when they rebooted the Star Wars movies the first few times, as an adult, I'm watching this, I'm like, what is going on? Like, there was too much happening. It felt like they were trying too hard. There was something, I mean, they were just trying too hard. I just wanted Punch and John like the way I remembered them. I just wanted them back.
I just wanted nothing to ever change.
Yeah. Did you guys not think that there should have been more stunts? I mean, specifically.
Of course there should have been. There should have been all stunts. I just wanted motorcycle chases.
Well, there were motorcycle chases, there were car chases, but there weren't jumps. There weren't motocross jumps. And we learn that this guy is a motocross rider.
Right.
And there were a few. We had a couple. But I kind of thought that this thing would be wall-to-wall amazing leaps and bounds and jumps, and they just didn't show up.
Yeah, I mean, I think part of that is you're seeing a little bit of the film's budget at work. Yeah. This is for a major studio release, it's a fairly low-budget movie. It is missing some of that. I do think that this movie may benefit from lower expectations in the future. To me, this is a movie that did not need a big budget studio release in theaters. This feels like a movie that should have been released directly to HBO at 2:00 in the afternoon. And on the poster, it should have said, Chips 2017, 1 star.
and you just get it all on the table.
You know, and you're scrolling through your on-demand menu and you see Chips 2017, 1 star, and you're like, you know what? I'm going to watch that.
You know you guys have done that, and I have too.
I
find a 1-star movie at 2 in the afternoon, I will, if I'm like, okay, I got to entertain myself.
There is a Mindless. Time of day when I want a 1-star movie.
Yep.
I think if you watch this that way, if you have the opportunity to watch this that way, I'm not recommending it. It does not work. But Dax Shepard is clearly trying to make a certain kind of movie that he probably watched on cable. And I think if you think of it that way, it may work better. If you are one of the people who saw Chips or are one of the far greater number of people who opted not to see Chips, let us know what you think. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH. When we come back, it'll be time for our favorite segment, What's Making Us Happy This Week, so come right back.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Match, where you can find the meaningful connection you are looking for. Match is number one in first dates and also in second dates. Plus, finding your someone is easier when you download their mobile app. Get your matches sent directly to your phone. For Pop Culture Happy Hour listeners, go to match.com/pop to get 7 days completely free to search and connect on Match today.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It is time for our favorite segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week? Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week, buddy?
A little show called Legion. Oh, we already talked about it.
Yeah.
Oh, why am I making that my happy? Because we talked, I think, about the first three episodes, and this show turns around
I
with episode four. I felt like the show back in the day when we talked about it was a little too self-satisfied. It thought its premise is what is real, what is fantasy? It thinks that's more interesting and innovative than it actually turned out to be. But I liked the look and I liked the performances, so I stuck with it. Episode four begins with a monologue by Jemaine Clement, and that means I am in. It gets funnier and weirder, and it finds out what it's about. And it has some brilliant set pieces, some action sequences, some character sequences, especially Bill Irwin. And it has mood sequences, which may or may not involve Aubrey Plaza dancing to Nina Simone's Feeling Good. So it's telling its story very specifically. When I use the word specific, some people don't know what I mean it's telling a story that only it could tell in a way only it could do it. It's great. It's one of my favorite pieces of television that I've seen in a while. So Legion, go back to it.
Thank you very much, Glenn Weldon. Hey, back in the studio after a brief Chips-related respite. Gene Demby, what is making you happy this week?
So I'm really excited to dig into Ken Liu's The Paper Menagerie and other short stories. I don't know if you guys remember this, but back in like 2012 or so, Ken Liu got a lot of attention for this short story he wrote called The Paper Menagerie, which is this really beautiful, heartbreaking, I mean, like I read it at my desk at work after my colleague Kat Chow sent it to me, and I was a mess for the rest of the day. It's a beautiful short story, and it's the sort of anchor of this new collection of short stories, or not a new collection of short stories, but it's a collection that is new to me that I'm looking forward to reading. I probably will not do it during work hours. I'll probably make sure that it's a weekend and I'm alone and I don't have any sort of social engagements afterwards, because that short story was beautiful and sharp and just hits at a bunch of stuff that like we care about at Code Switch, but also just really like masterfully done. It was one of those things like, oh, this person is different from us. This is a kind of writing that very few people are capable of pulling off. So that's what I'm excited about. That's what's making me happy.
Thank you, Gene Demby. That sounds great. Brittany Luce, also back. What's making you happy this week?
So what's making me happy this week, actually, not necessarily something new. I'm actually, I've been obsessed with the singer, the alternative R&B singer SZA for a few years. Yep. And she last released an EP in 2014 called Z. She has this new album called Control that is not yet out yet. And like the release date keeps getting pushed back.
Yeah, it's moved around
and further
a lot.
Further back. Yes, it's driving me nuts. But she's like, her music is like really what helps me get through a really tough deadline, which I had last week. So when I find myself in this sort of a pickle where I need SZA and I have no new SZA music, I've just been listening to her song from a couple years ago, Sobriety, and also her new song, Drew Barrymore, just on repeat. That's why I'll just listen to both of them, sometimes alternating based upon the hour. And I have to say that at the end of maybe like 3 or 4 days of doing this, I still love both songs. So what's making me happy this week are like one kind of new SZA song and one older SZA song, Sobriety and Drew Barrymore. Somebody spark the blood, let's start the night, goes off at episode one. Bring the gin, got the juice, bring the sin, got that too. Won't you shut up, no, you're my favorite.
Nice.
Thank you very much, Brittany Luce. David Green, what is making you happy this week?
You know what's making me happy? It is a book by Cheech Marin. I'm talking about from Cheech and Chong.
All right.
It's his memoir. Cheech is not my real name, but don't call me Chong. I went to his home overlooking the Pacific Ocean above Malibu to meet him, to talk to him about it. He is just pure joy. And the stories in the book, I mean, they are hysterical. He takes us back to the moment when he and Tommy Chong decided on the name of their group, Cheech and Chong. They were up in Canada driving in Tommy Chong's dad's car, windshield wipers that didn't work. They were using a coat hanger, crossing an abandoned bridge. And, you know, Cheech said, I was named Chicharron was the nickname that my parents gave me because I looked like a little pork rind when I was born. But it was so fitting that they were in this bizarre moment. And I said, you know, why was it fitting that you were in some horrible car crossing an abandoned bridge? He was like, because it's, you got these Chicano, Chinese, Canadian, improvisational strip bar guys who are going to conquer the world. And good luck with that. But they kind of did.
Wow. Give me the name of the book again.
It is called Cheech Is Not My Real Name, But Don't Call Me Chung.
Excellent. Thank you, David Green.
You got it.
All right. So for What's Making Me Happy this week, I turned my attention to my children to pass along the things that have so gripped their entire lives that I want to pass them along as recommendations as if they were coming from me. Because every once in a while, it's good to hear from the young people. I bought my kids a Nintendo Switch a few weeks ago, and my son, who's 16, has been playing Breath of the Wild, the Legend of Zelda game, Breath of the Wild. And so I sat down with him yesterday. I'm like, what is it? What do you like about it? And he was talking about how it's this open world and it's so imaginative and you can wander around. But as I said, you're in your room a lot. Like, how much time have you spent with this game that he's had for like maybe 2 weeks? And he said, oh, I would say 60 hours. So clearly Breath of the Wild has something going on, up to and including the fact that I bought this game for him for $60, and I'm pretty pleased with that dollar an hour rate. Is pretty sweet. As for my 13-year-old daughter, she has been watching a Netflix show, a subtitled Japanese teen soap opera called Good Morning Call. And all I can really say about her response is that I was in the other room and she just kept screaming at the TV. Apparently it's based on a manga. My daughter is obsessed with manga and with anime, and I've talked about how she's obsessed with Yuri on Ice and all these things. If your kid is into all of those things and it says, wow, my kid is into the exact same thing as yours, check out Good Morning Call, because my 13-year-old will not stop watching and screaming at it. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow the show at PCHH. You can follow me at I Dislike Steven. You can follow Glenn Weldon at GH Weldon and David Green at NPR Green. That's Green with an E. You can follow Brittany Luce at BM Luce. That's BMLUSE. And you can follow Gene Demby at GD215. That's GEEDEE215. You can follow our producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica_Reedy. And you can follow our producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff. That's K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in-and-out music, which you are tapping your foot to now. So thanks to all of you for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you, Stephen.
Thanks for listening, and we will see you right back here next week.